Welcome to the Amazon Legends Podcast, where we have real stories about making it big on Amazon. Our guests are CEOs of large companies and entrepreneurs who became powerful sellers, also experts specializing in helping sellers, and both former and current Amazon employees who will give us an insight from behind the scenes. Here's your host, Nick Urisin.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Amazon Legends. Today, I have a guest who is going to give us the perspective of multiple sellers, because he used to be an Amazon seller before, but now he actually runs a company. He's in the management team who deals with multiple sellers. So we're going to have a good perspective. So his name is Zalman Teldon. He's the vice president of Endigo. And he's been a long time Amazon seller, now manages marketplaces at Endigo. And also he's a proud father and loves the challenge, both personal and professional, and especially if it involves growth. So Endigo is an e-commerce consulting company for sellers and vendors of Wayfair, Overstock, and Amazon. And their focus is in housewares and furniture. So with that, welcome, Zalman. So tell us about something that your clients are doing really well right now, and especially on Amazon, but give us the perspective of how that applies to other marketplaces as well.
What do we do really well? I think an area that I found that really helps brands is basket size, right? Average order value. Average order value has become more and more critical as Amazon fees go up, as marketplace fees go up. Your $10 item doesn't become very viable for the product anymore, because now you have to start charging $12, $15, $18 to sell that same product. So bundling is something that we found to be tremendously successful. There are some clients that I'm working with now suggesting how to take another look at your products. And you know, some of the products, it's really interesting. You find there was a product I was working with a while back that we found that average customer was buying over 2 units per order. And that's phenomenal. That data just tells you absolutely you want to sell that as 2 packs, not as 1 packs. And it's more profitable, obviously. I think something that might be lost on some sellers is that when Amazon is doing a pick and pack, it's per item. Right. So if someone orders 2 units, you're being billed 2 pick and packs for that. If you build that as a bundle of 2, you get charged 1 pick and pack. So your £1 $5 pick and pack is now a £2 $5.85 pick and pack. And it's just better margin, better conversion, better customer experience.
Yeah. So this happens to be one of my favorite areas when I start working with clients. So let's dig into this bundling, because, you know, it's people don't understand bundling. What am I going to bundle with? So let's talk about that. And also tell us some of the logistics of what's involved in creating a bundle, and give us some examples of your favorite way of bundling.
So I have found in my last role as a director of e-commerce at a consumer goods company, we found that bundling different colors of products doesn't necessarily work as well as a 2-pack of the same exact product. And it's interesting, because you'd think that 2 products of 2 good sellers would be a no-brainer for the seller, for the buyer, for the customer. But at the end of the day, you would, let's say, try to bundle a boy color and a girl color. But at the end of the day, that becomes very specific, right? The mom has to be interested in buying that for both kids. The dad has to be, the children both have to want that same product, right? So it's a lot more predefined for the consumer, and therefore it's going to be harder to get them to buy that. When you're telling a customer, hey, you can buy 2 of these, $10 a piece, or 2 of these at $18 for 2, the customer's motivated to purchase 2 of them. They feel that they're getting a deal, and they are getting a deal, and we're getting a deal. We're getting better conversions, we're getting better profits, and better customer experience. And I think that's something that speaks to the customer.
So you are suggesting that when it comes to practical terms, it's best to create packs rather than, so this is just my decision. I call them, if it's the same item but multiple pieces, I call them packs. But if it's different items put together, I call them bundle. But for Amazon purposes, they're all called bundling. However, it helps you define. So for the purpose of our conversation, you're suggesting packs are better than bundles,
correct,
where you have different items, because you never know what the person is going to want.
Amazon tries to encourage virtual bundles, right? They have that option to create virtual bundles. Have you ever used them, the virtual bundles?
No, tell us about that.
The virtual bundles, I haven't used a lot, but virtual bundles is essentially create two ASINs and then tell Amazon that you'd like to sell these two together, and they create a third ASIN. And then a customer buys that third ASIN and Amazon will pick and pack both of those. The benefit of that is that you can test a bunch of things. But the downside is then you're once again paying for that pick and pack fee on both of those. So eventually, once you know that a customer is buying multiples of this one product, creating those, whether it's in-house or through a 3PL, a lot of them do bundling packs. And then eventually, if it's a strong enough seller, eventually you want to order it from China or wherever your manufacturing is as a bundle. It's obviously going to be much cheaper at the source to bundle it or pack it than bringing it into your DC or your 3PL and having them bundle it. So once you get enough data, you take a look at that and make that decision early on.
Yeah, one of the things that, again, as part of the whole bundling process, one of the questions that I get very often when I start with a client and they're not familiar with this, they say, so if we just send so many pieces, Amazon will take care of it? And I say no. So the most critical thing is, let's say that you're creating a three pack, three pieces of the same item, or one of this and one of that, create a bundle of two different items sold as one SKU. You have to issue your own UPC to that. And that UPC has to be clearly displayed on the side of the item on the packaging. And so the other thing that goes with that is you can absolutely send a case full of singles with their UPC, a case full of those three packs with their UPC, and Amazon will break that case up, but by that granular piece that comes out of that case is going to be the three pack as one SKU, which has its own. So that's critical. The only thing that they cannot do is you cannot instruct Amazon, and there's no way to do it, to take X number of three packs and break them up into single. No, you have to bring them back, take it apart yourself, and then send them out as singles.
And it's to your point, it's critical to put on it "do not break" or "sold as pack" or whatever the verbiage is that you'd like to use, but very clearly define this ASIN, this FN SKU, as something that Amazon should not break and is sold as a pack. I recall years ago, one of my first products selling a packet of face masks. And they were individually wrapped and really nice, and they were then wrapped with some sort of wrapper around the middle of these five face masks. And it was before the time that Amazon had the do not break. And I sent them in, and then all of a sudden I had so much inventory, and I was like, what's going on here? Until customers started complaining that you sold it as five, and I'm only getting one. I was like, oh no. So Amazon, you know, someone at the warehouse was kind enough to break it up and make sure that I have all my inventory accounted for. And now I have five units instead of one. They obviously instituted that, and it's effective. It's helpful. Of course, if you're doing it in a poly bag, it's important to make sure you use the right poly bags that Amazon has defined, what thickness, you know, that it has to be opaque and all those things.
If it's for children and things like that, you know, with the right warning. So, there are so many advantages to this. First of all, you up the average order value. And the chances are, if you are doing, for example, a two-pack, your FBA fee is going to be the same as a single one. And as yet, in this case, you are almost doubling. Of course, you want to make it more attractive. You don't exactly double the price, but close enough. So there are many advantages. And this is so critical. I do this all the time. We set the revenue model. And in this revenue model, we create the packs or the bundles. And then we say, okay, right at the beginning, when we do this, we also say, okay, we are going to offer actually a coupon code for the bundles, but nothing for the singles. And we say we're going to offer a coupon code for the total spent, because you can, as you know, you can create those. So what that means is they are encouraged to buy the bundle or the packs in order to meet that threshold. And then they throw in a single. So now everybody's laughing. And at the same time, you know, the customer is getting value. So those are the kinds of things we do right at the beginning, before even looking at keywords, listings, or anything. We put that in. And what you're doing is exactly, you know, the right thing, because this is all about making money. And if you're not going to make money, what's the point of, you know, getting keywords and doing volume, right?
Yep.
So now that we started on the strategy, so to speak, so obviously this is for people who are not doing arbitrage, but they're selling their own items. So going in that direction, what is the next thing you're looking at on a listing?
Sorry, just to go back to the arbitrage, it's interesting. What I've seen some people do is, if you have, whether it's retail arbitrage or you have, let's say, you know, in the camera category, a lot of people do that. They'll sell a camera that everyone has access to, but then they'll bundle it with other products that they may have really steep pricing on, or a loss leader they'll take on a product, or they have one product that is exclusive, and then they're the only ones that could sell that listing. So with retail arbitrage, people may be able to do that, but it really doesn't apply.
I mean, it's still, they would still need to register as a manufacturer to get their UPC. And I mean, I prefer the bundles. I have a GoPro. And when it first came out, you know, you never buy the camera and then you're done. You know, you have to buy all these accessories. And I saw several, and that's what I went. You know, they had the case, they had extra batteries and a charger. So that's a bundle. And you actually look for those bundles. And you're right, especially in electronics.
Yeah.
So, it's a great strategy either way. So, let's move on to the next important thing on the listing. So you created the listing, you come up with a good revenue model, it's going to make good money, and you're going to do your promotions, of course. But what else are you watching on that listing?
Content is next. Next thing I look at, and advertising is critical as well. Content is interesting. It evolves with time, right? What was a really nice image 5 years ago is just not the same today. There's different ways to photograph. Styles change. And then the quality of images changes over time. I think some brands have a difficult time maintaining the catalog. Besides titles and bullet points that fall off, images fall off, and where you may have built a beautiful listing 5 years ago, the listing might not be where you want it to be today. And if your competitors are now using different type of content, it's really important to not only to grow sales, but to now maintain your status quo. It's important to have what is popular in the market. So infographics used to be really a luxury. No one needed to have infographics. No one needed to have A+ content. You know, on mobile today, where much of the revenue is driven, as you scroll, I think on a lot of listings, the images come before your description. So your infographic can actually be telling the story a lot better than whatever description. You may have a beautiful description, but it might not even be seen because someone stops at the images. That's the reality today, right? People are looking for, there's a reason TikTok is doing better than YouTube now, because people have that 14-second attention span. Though I think TikTok just announced that they're going to be extending their video time. So in case you wanted to get into TikTok, you now have an opportunity.
why is content so important, and what is the ultimate goal of good content?
Conversions, right? The way I think of it is the copy, the bullets, all that, all the SEO work that is being done is the equivalent of someone deciding to walk into your brick and mortar store, right? They saw your advertisement and they're like, okay, I'll walk into your brick and mortar store. So they're clicking on your page. Now, what's going to get them to actually pick up your product is going to be images, right? You need to further draw them in. They're in your store now. Why are they going to pick up this brand of I don't know, what's the biggest aisle in the grocery store? Is it toothpaste or is it cereal? But whatever it is, why are they going to pick that one up off the shelf and then pick it up and look at? That's where you start reading the details and the reviews and all that. So all that really it's really a package deal. And yes, of course, you'll get sales with some of that and not all of that. Particularly with launch, it's hard. You have to really invest in some areas that are not, to compensate for the areas that are not as strong. But ultimately, it's really a package deal. You want to get the customer into your store, right? They're clicking on the link. Then you have to get them to take that product off the shelf and take a look at it and ultimately make that decision. So when there's, particularly with complex products, if it's electronics or other things, you need to have a really detailed listing that is explaining the benefits of the product. And something I find really helpful is addressing the concerns of the product, right? Because it's great to make a sale, but if there's a ton of returns on that sale, it on that listing, it's not helpful to your product. So addressing those up front, I think, shows integrity. And I think it also answers questions that this is not for your model iPhone. This is not for your whatever it is. You know, your baby will. This is for up to 2 years old and nothing more. So being very clear in as much as you can, while also selling the product as much as you can. I think today, again, people are drawn by imagery, and what you can tell in a infographic is a lot more. To me, as a consumer, I'd say. I'm going to be drawn in more with that than reading a bunch of long tail keywords that you've stuffed into the description.
Exactly. I mean, those keywords are good to bring the exposure to your listing, but once they are on the listing page, that's it. You need them to add it to cart and pay for it.
Yeah.
And that's the conversion. So let's
also add two to cart.
Yeah, so let's clarify the conversion. We're not talking about advertising. We're not talking about any of those sponsored ads. We're talking about somebody's on your listing page and they add the item to the cart and they check out paying for it. That's the idea. So 100 people landing on your listing page, how many of them are actually completing the sale? So now that leads me to my next question. How do you track that? What is the tool that you're using? What is the methodology and the tool, if there is one, that you're using, and how often, and then what are you watching?
That's a good question. I'd say that one of the wonderful things about data is that it's there, it's available, and you get to analyze it. One of the challenging things about data when it's in abundance is that it's hard to constantly monitor and track. There's a tool that I recently became aware of that I've been messing around with. Let me just look over here. It's based on Google Sheets, Gorilla ROI, using the Amazon API, integrated with Google Sheets, and basically through formulas, you can pull in data that is on your seller account. They have one built also for agencies, so you could have multiple seller accounts. And then you can start, you drop in an ASIN or a SKU, and it gives you a lot of data. So they have some templates that you could use. So I've been playing around with those and hopefully be able to use translate my Excel skills into this Gorilla ROI on Google Docs skills. But it's critical. Not only that, share a buy box, right? Like if you're losing buy box for whatever reason, Do you ever see like on products that you have exclusives that you're missing?
Tell us about how that happens, because a lot of people say, oh, we are the only one selling, but no, it doesn't really work, right?
No, but my guess, what I've just assumed all the time, is that if you're low on inventory, so you only have inventory in Florida right now, but a customer is looking for it in the Northwest, Amazon's not going to show that buy box as available because that's not in their best interest. Not only Amazon's best interest for that product, but it's also not in the consumer's best interest to see that product because they're not going to get it in 2 days. So Amazon, they're not suppressing the buy box, but there's something to that either they're disallowing sales for customers in the regions that don't have inventory, or the buy box is suppressed. I mean, we know that if you put in a search term where you are, and I put in a search term where I am, we're going to see different products, and it's not just based on advertising.
Oh yeah.
The customer.
So I tell you what my experience has been.
Yeah.
I've seen. I'm sure it's not just what I've seen. There's other scenarios, but first of all, as you know, people buy stuff and they return. So there's a percentage of returns, and most of those returns people send back, they go back into stock. So Amazon does a pretty good job putting them back in stock. And that means the inventory goes up for that particular seller, and then, you know, it gets resold. So that's fine. But sometimes the Amazon thinks that it's not good enough to add to that seller's inventory. Right. As yet, they really don't want to tell the seller this is not saleable either.
So
they receive the return is reported good condition, but they lose it, and then they find it down the road, or they damage it after receiving it. So all that kind of inventory that they get inspected, and then Amazon determines, you know, there's nothing wrong with this, or they can repackage it, they can repair the package. Usually people return stuff if the packaging is a little bit damaged, but actually the product is good. And they list them as used, but good condition. And then if you look carefully, it will say item in original packaging, item in original packaging, but packaging damaged. So, but the bottom line is you're losing the buy box.
Yeah. It's sold by Amazon Warehouse or whatever. Yep, very good point.
Yeah, so they say it's sold by Amazon Warehouse. The other scenario that I know happened to one of my clients is he created a promotion, and the promotion was created without a cap on how many pieces somebody could buy. So, and he offered, it was a launch thing, and this is about 3-4 years ago.
Yeah.
And he offered deep discount on it. So this guy bought like 100 pieces, and the next thing is he's listed on the same item as an alternative seller. And that's another one. So if you're not careful, you definitely have to put a cap on the promotion, how many pieces can be sold in each order. So, you know, you never know. And or alternatively, I've seen that too. People actually, they sell on multiple marketplaces. And of course, Amazon is tracking the pricing. And they offer discount on Walmart or somewhere else. And then they see it, and then they take you off the buy box, and it's not available. And you never know why.
I just had a client who had a seller on their listing and didn't know what it was. So ordered. And then as they ordered it, they got the order themselves to fulfill it. It was coming from one of these dropshippers, you know, cross-referencing dropshippers. That had it listed, he bought it on Walmart, and then to fulfill the Amazon order, which we know is frowned upon by Amazon and Walmart. But then what do you do, right? Do you cancel that order and get Walmart upset, or do you fulfill it and then reach out to the customer? But yeah, there's plenty of that goes right.
Yeah. So so at the end of the day, you can't just do a knee jerk reaction for these different scenarios. You can't just offer a discount without really thinking it through. So you have to have a revenue model, you have to have a promotion strategy of, you know, how much you're going to offer, under what conditions, on what channel, and you need to have these records in the store so that you can go back and see what discounts you offer, because Amazon will track those. And of course, what you said is absolutely the thing to do.
Back to the data thing about the content, and it applies to the discounts also. What I've done is you take a snapshot of a month where you, before you run a promotion or change content, and then you run a snapshot of a month where you change content. Right now, Amazon allows you to do, on at least on the seller side, the A/B testing on images, and you can take a snapshot during that period, and then take a snapshot of conversions afterwards. And the data tells a story. The data is the data. We tell the story as we want to tell it. But sometimes it's pretty clear that the promotion didn't work as you want, or it was short-lived, right? It gave a lift for 3 weeks afterwards, but then it died out. Or content that your brand new image actually was detrimental to your sales. So.
Yeah, so I mean, what you were talking about in terms of conversion rate, so it's so critical to track conversion. Also, what you want is really, you want daily tracking of the conversion so that you can make historical comparisons by also logging the changes you made and then the impact. So that's what you were just talking about. So it's not, I mean, this is, you can't do this. Oh, let's take a look at the data. Let's download it or whatever. It doesn't work like that, because data, you need to have a perspective on what's going on, and you need to have a record of the events that triggered those changes. And also, I'll just download it, put it in my Excel document. Excel, what is Excel? It's rows and rows and rows of numbers. You're going to understand what from that. You have to visualize that data. So unfortunately, there is no such tool that fetches it and then presents it and all that stuff.
I recently started, I'm almost finished with the data analysis course. Google, through Coursera, offers a data analyst certification. They offer it as a career path, and I was like, you know what, I'm not looking for a new career path, but this will definitely help me in my career.
Absolutely, you need it. I mean, today you need it. I mean, can you imagine? Let's say you live in one of those states where public transport is really almost next to not available. So you have to know how to drive, right? You can't live there. So this is, if you're running a business and you're doing business online, you have to know how to handle data, how to store it, how to organize it, how to read it, how to visualize it, what tools are available. This is, if you're running a business, you have to have that. Otherwise, you're flying blind.
Yeah. So Excel is great, but there's so much. I mean,
I mean, plus they changed Excel. You know, they moved on to the old Excel. You could import a text file, and you would just see rows of data, and then you could do things. Now, when you import a text file into Excel, it turns it into a table. It comes with all kinds of queries, and because they want to make it available for other applications to speak to it. So it's not for an average person anymore. It's you need to know what you're doing. Anyway, well, this is really useful. What we just discussed in detail, very useful, because first, it's about making money. Second, it's about getting a return on every listing that you put. Without these two, doing the right things, you're just basically wasting your time and money buying, selling inventory. Okay, so let's talk a little bit of, you know, the high level. What do you see? Why Amazon? Obviously, you are also selling, your clients are selling on other marketplaces. Why should Amazon be part of people's consideration? And if it has to be, where would people start? Is it at the beginning or after they gain some experience? What are your recommendations for a seller that's just starting out?
For someone that's just started, I think my personal opinion is brands should be on every marketplace, and even premium brands. It depends what level. But there are direct to consumer brands, for example, that are like, nope, we're not going on Amazon. And I get that, right? You don't want to depreciate the value of the brand and whatever. There are many considerations that absolutely make sense. However, something that will happen is your brand will end up on Amazon. You're not going to be in control of it, right? There's a, I think it was a while ago, I noticed doTERRA, right? They do the essential oils. And they have tiers of sellers and buyers, and I'm not sure exactly how what their business model is, but a lot of people have access to the brand. And for this was a couple of years back, it was pretty clear to me that they did not have a brand strategy for Amazon. A bunch of people creating listings and multi-packs and all that, but no one from doTERRA was taking an approach of how are we going to appear on Amazon. In today's, you see like the Thrasios and everyone else. In today's day and age, there's part of your brand equity is the way you appear on Amazon. So even if it's not about sales on Amazon, just the way you appear as a brand, your reviews, all those things are going to be impacted. If you're a brand that's selling I remember once looking at One Wheel, and they weren't on Amazon, and looking at their, but yet there were people selling One Wheel on Amazon, and you know it's going to be twice the price because they're buying it retail and selling it on Amazon, and then you get negatives because the negative reviews are this is way overpriced. It's not about the product. It's not about the. It could be a great product, but you're still going to have a bad brand image and a negative customer experience. So when a brand like Thrasio is looking at one of the things they're looking at for Amazon brands is brand equity, and other investors also, when they're looking at a company and their value, they're looking at the brand in a holistic way, and part of that is the way you appear on Amazon. So that's for large companies. For small sellers, I think it kind of depends in the beginning. It kind of depends on bandwidth. You might want to, if your skill set is the Amazon side or e-commerce or those type of things, then maybe that's where you dive in and leave the logistics to someone else or leave the product development to someone else. But if you're coming to the business from the product development side and your skill set is not in sales and marketing on Amazon, maybe tap into someone else's experience and knowledge on that side. And with time, you can then invest in bringing someone on board and having someone that really knows that, has that skill set and knows that area. But really, I think bandwidth is a big question. Know yourself, know your skill set, and really focus on that to build the business.
So this what you said about your appearance on Amazon as a brand is important, and this has become even more important recently, where Amazon and Google made this deal where Amazon serves up the search results for product searches on Google. So people are constantly going on Google doing their searches, and the brand will come up. As soon as the system recognizes this is a product, they'll start bringing up the Amazon listings. And
sometimes before the brand listing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's what you're saying. Okay.
Yeah, and then you have they have those product pictures, and they Amazon is there, and then underneath you have the organic listings. So these are all coming from Amazon. So let's talk about companies that actually don't do direct to consumer themselves, but they have a supply chain and their supply chain is on Amazon. What do you say to those people? Should they be also creating their own Amazon account just for the purposes of representation of the brand, or just let the resellers take care of it? And what are the pros and cons?
I think you ask what the pros and cons are. There's plenty of each. And I think the first question is brand has to ask themselves, what are their immediate and long-term goals? If it's brand image, you need to take control, because when there's multiple sellers, everyone's contributing data and content, and Amazon, smart as the data is, gets very confused as to whose data should be I think we all like to believe that brand registry addressed that, but I have not found that to be accurate, that, you know, if a brand is, has a brand registry, that automatically their content gets picked first. I don't know if you find similar, but it doesn't seem that it's by default set to use the brand registered content. If it's a sales play, you know, if a brand, client, I know there are people selling their products, or listeners selling their product, that are definitely losing money. And the question is why. I don't know that anyone will know. And then the question is for the brand, like, what is your, do you want to have sales volume, or do you want to take control of the brand? You want to make sure the brand image is protected. Do you want to make sure that your listings on Home Depot or Bed Bath or Target or wherever else you're selling are not going to be suppressed because of price point? And these are business strategic decisions that have to be made. I think a really healthy approach, if someone is not yet willing or able to manage that all on their own, is ask advice, right? There are plenty of agencies, there are plenty of sellers, there are plenty of retailers that are willing to help. And you shopping around and making sure that someone has a deep understanding, again, of what your needs are. There are agencies that will promote that selling through Vendor Central is the absolute best because there's no storage capacity limits. And then there are others that will say, oh, Seller Central is the best thing that ever happened because you are fully in control of your brand. Everyone's got a pitch, right? We've all got a story to tell and something to sell. So the question really is, when you have these conversations, what aligns best with your brand's needs for the short, for the long term? And those might be different, right? You might need something now that doesn't align with what you need in 10 years.
So I'm going to push back on a couple of things you said, just so that, you know, I'll make the point of why. So first of all, if you are doing arbitrage, obviously that's a different thing. We're talking about building your own brand, and we're not talking about Nike or Adidas or a company like that to build a brand. We're talking about small guys, entrepreneurial, building their brands. That's what we're talking about. So if that's the audience, building a brand is not a sales operation. Building a brand is a strategic approach to build value. So it's not about building sales. It's about building value. There is a difference. Value translates into sales. So how do you do that? Well, you can do it in many ways, but there is one thing that is 100% certain. It's going to take you time, right? It's not going to happen in 1 year, because it's going to be, first of all, 2 months plus to build the listing and then launch it and then advertising by the time you sell. It's going to take time. So
what do they say about an overnight success takes 5 years?
Exactly. Yeah. So you're going to spend a lot of time. So if you are spending time, it's never about sales volume.
Yeah.
It's about longevity of building that sales volume. So that's fact number one. Fact number two is, this is your brand. It is in your best interest to make sure that the value of it is maximized, because investors will look for that. You will want that because you're going to get more revenue by selling less number of pieces. So you're not doing legwork. So who has this interest at heart? You or your resellers? Your resellers will simply try to make money out of reselling your item. And of course, on Amazon, it will become race to the bottom very quickly if there are multiple sellers. And at some point, they're going to say, nah, you know, we're not making money. We're not going to carry it anymore. Then who's losing? Plus, in the meantime, your brand took a major hit by being dirt cheap.
Yep.
So that's another point. That's why you have to make sure that you take control of your selling. The third thing is, when you have resellers selling it and you don't have a direct control on the marketplace for your listing, then on Amazon, there's something called merchant of authority. That means that whoever is the seller, based on the seller's credentials, they get to change the content on a listing if there is no ownership for a listing. Of course, by relinquishing that control, you've already declared to the whole world that I have no control over this listing. And Amazon system will simply let you change as a good seller, whatever content is there. So that's another fact. So now you may say, okay, well, what if it's vendor central versus seller central? Well, the answer is also, unless you have like a major deal with Amazon where Amazon is your customer, they're doing placing big POs and really promoting it, which is very rarely the case for smaller ones, then forget about vendor central, because at best, the listing is controlled by Amazon. They will ask you to provide the content, but if on seller central, you don't like the title, you change it. It's instant. You don't like the content, you want to add more pictures, you want to add video, it's instant if you are the registered brand owner. But with vendor central, good luck. Plus, duplicates get created all the time. So, I mean, this is the reason why I say, even if you're not selling, open a seller central account, get your brand on brand registry, and make sure that you have control of your listings. And also in the process, you can maintain price, you know, regulate your price, because Amazon will let you throw out anybody, include the MAP policy and things like that. So that's why I say, you know, it really does not depend so much if you are a company looking to build a brand. But if you are a big company, you have brands, then you can do anything you want.
There's, if we had all the time of the day, there's so many different parts to that, you know, that I touched upon, that you touched upon, that are like, I'm sure, debate for hours. But to me, that's one of the fun things about this industry is the there's so many constant changes to the, to the world that you have to try to maintain knowledge of. And sometimes it's playing, you know, in some cases, playing vendor against seller. And doing it intentionally and strategically, you know, knowing which buttons to push and pull, and where to, you know, where to back off, where to push on Amazon. It's fun. It really is fun and stressful.
It keeps you young, you know, because you have to constantly keep learning new stuff. So Zaman, let's talk a little bit about one of my favorite subjects. You work with several sellers, you've been a seller yourself, so you have many different perspectives. And also, obviously, you are an agency right now, you are an agency, so you obviously want people to come to you for your services. But either way, you being part of it, you as an agency being part of it, what is the makeup of a good team to have a successful Amazon operation? Define the roles and responsibilities, and what is a good idea to outsource, what is a good idea to keep in-house? Because as you know, even though you are an agency, I'm sure you will agree that there is no like 100% outsource. You have to be involved, which means that you need to monitor what's going on. So give us your take on the makeup of a successful Amazon operation team.
That's a tough one. Please get this. No, tough one because there are so many different ways to look at it. Just touching back on the value proposition, right? So one of the parts of the value of a business is looking at the long-term value to investors and to potentially during an exit. If you outsource, are you really bringing value if everything's outsourced versus building it internally? And if you build everything internally, then you are a solid team and there's value to that. But building a solid team can be very expensive. I think that's a you know, for example, when it comes to advertising is a really important part of the Amazon play. And having a solid person can be expensive, but justifiable. But can an individual person do the same job that you outsource to an agency? I mean, I have opinions. And it depends on the account, right? It'll depend on the account.
But don't be shy. I can tell you, no. The answer is no, because it's constantly changing and it takes dedication and it takes a lot of time. So that's definitely an outsourced deal, right?
Right. But then, right, photography, you probably have specific needs for your brand anyways. There's a brand deck, there's a brand guide. So you might want to keep that in-house. I hate to sound like my one answer is it depends on your needs, but really, right, you really have to understand your needs, understand and do an analysis for each part of it. Then there's also the structure, right? There's how is the structure for your organization? Are you a organization that has a full e-commerce department and e-commerce is control of its fulfillment and warehouse and all that, making those decisions on its own? Or is e-commerce a leg of the entire organization? And depending on the organization for finance, for fulfillment, for all the other critical parts that make an e-commerce business happen. So I think if you have, you know, for the latter, when you have that amazing support of your organization internally, there's not a lot that you have to really consider outsourcing, because you have a solid organization. If your organization is struggling to support you in ways that then inhibit your ability to grow on Amazon and focus on sales on the marketplaces and online, on your D2C, whatever it is, then you might want to start outsourcing certain parts. And again, outsourcing, many outsourcing agents, whether it's a full-on agency or, you know, different parts of your workload, they're not long-term commitments. You can have someone focused on, but a 3PL, right? You can use them for a period of 6 months till you figure out how to get your own thing going. Finance, there are companies and organizations that do that. Advertising, content, all these things. Fiverr is full of these things. You can even find people doing advertising, helping for advertising on Fiverr. You want to vet these people and really understand that they're going to be in alignment with what your strategy is and understand what you need, and maybe don't give over all the keys at once. But really, I think understanding your organization's strength and then outsourcing. If it's someone, you know, talking about the startup, the alternative to outsourcing is hiring. And hiring, you're not going to find someone that has all the skill sets that you're looking for, exactly. Right? What's that first person you're hiring? Are they going to do the advertising? Are they going to do the financials? Are they going to do the photography and the socials? So being honest with oneself and understanding, you know, if I were opening a business, understanding what my weaknesses are and knowing that my next hire has to be someone that fills that area, and then other roles can be outsourced.
Mm-hmm. You're right about, I mean, everything you said is so on point. So let me give you my take on this. So I say this. So first of all, if you are a new operation and you're getting started online and Amazon, or online or Amazon, and you are new, you are a startup. So everything has to be done from scratch. Now, the key is to build things for scale, because there is no, once you start growing, you just kept doing band-aids, then it's all gonna fall apart and sales will go away. So the very little success that you're gonna get that you cannot capitalize, it's gonna disappear very quickly. So you have to make sure how to build infrastructure as a startup. So that's number one. Number two, if you are a mature operation, so let's say that you are a mature operation, take a conventional company with a supply chain, and they decided, you know what, the trend is, we have to be online, we have to do direct to consumer, and let's start with Amazon because that's where the money is, most of the, you know, huge market share, let's start there. Well, guess what? They are a startup, because their operation is not set up for online. So this is what I call tail, you know, wagging the dog, because Amazon will come with these requirements and they're going to be right at the beginning. They're not going to want to do anything because they've got an infrastructure. Well, guess what? This has to be handled totally separately. So as a practical solution, I say to them, look, this is not going to integrate into your system. First of all, do FBA. Don't go into fulfilling yourself. And then treat it as a separate company. You know, just as a virtual, set up a virtual company on the books, and then make a inventory sale to them when you are sending an FBA shipment, but treat it separately from its financials, its demand planning, and you name it, because it's not going to integrate into how you run your business.
Yep. And getting an entire organization to turn toward an operation, an e-commerce operation, it's not going to happen. And if it does, it'll take a long time.
Yeah. So that's why. So bottom line, you have to treat it like a startup, no matter what size you are, and then have its own team, because this team is going to have different kind of mindsets, different kind of personalities, different kind of work arrangements. So it's always a good idea to almost silo the Amazon operation inside a bigger organization.
And related to that, it really is a startup. And just like in a startup, there's new terminology that people don't know. You're talking about a new product, et cetera.
Exactly.
I've learned the hard way that it was really interesting. A colleague of mine in the past, we were having a meeting. I forget what exactly the circumstances were, but there was a breakdown in communication. And finally, she said, an ASIN is the 10-digit identifier for Amazon. And that was like the whole thing, because we kept on referring to an ASIN, and that was lost on whoever it was. And to you and I, that's like, right? I'm sure we dream about ASINs and whatever, but to most other people, that doesn't make sense. Vendor versus seller, FBA, FBM, these things we can easily throw our own terms in that, you know, to use your point, as a startup, these are what we breathe and live. And this company has been working successfully for years without these terms. We have to be more understanding of that. I have to be more understanding of that and break things down a lot more frequently.
Yeah. So we're coming to the end. So I'm going to ask my favorite question. So if you could wish for Amazon to change one thing in their policies for sellers, what would that be?
I think communication. I think communication is something that many sellers struggle with. Communication with real people that can make real decisions. And obviously with the, I don't know, whatever the number of sellers it is, it's impossible for Amazon to accommodate everyone. But with more than 50%+ of sales now happening through sellers, And for many sellers, the only way to get communication is to pay Amazon for a rep. It becomes really challenging for a lot of sellers. And miscommunication, simple errors that then lead to account shutdowns, things like that become really, really frustrating for people. And you're talking about small businesses. You're talking about a lot of small businesses that a shutdown for a month can cost them their business. And a lot of aggravation for a lot of people also.
Oh, yes. And it becomes people's livelihood. So this is, it's a very big deal. You know, if they want to support a small business, that's what it is.
Yeah.
So great. So tell us about who Zalman Teldon is. Where do you live? I know, you know, you are a proud father, but tell us about yourself. What do you like to do when you have free time, if you have it?
that's the question, if I have it, right? I live in Chicago. I have four kids. One of them is driving already, and that's frightening. in my free time, I have a large extended family, four siblings and a bunch of nieces and nephews. One of them lives locally. I enjoy connecting with friends and family. Really enjoy time with my kids, and making time for friends is something that I try to do. I I would like to, one day I'd like to be able to answer that question and say I am passionate about woodworking. Because when I think of it, I always think like that's something, that's an area I'd like to build a shop in my garage. One of my siblings is kind of active on Twitter, and his like bio says comedian, I don't know exactly what it is, comedian, chef, all these things, all in my own head. So,
that's so nice.
I can tell you all the things that I am in my head, but yeah, pretty, you know, otherwise simple life and I enjoy parts that I enjoy about my work are the challenges. Like I said, I enjoy facing a challenge, and I enjoy, I would not enjoy the work if it was, you know, every day, if it was the same exact work every day. Things that become rote are hard for me. And,
So tell us, how can people find you?
You can reach out to me on LinkedIn, Zalman Teldon. You can reach out to me, Facebook, same name. And my email address is zteldon@gmail.com. And any questions, I'd be happy to answer and be in touch.
Great. Thank you very much, Zalman. This has been great. I haven't asked any of my standard questions, but I think what we covered was so actionable, which is the way I like things. So thank you very much. And that brings us to the end of this episode. And see you next time.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. Be sure and subscribe, rate, and review our show. And be sure and share an episode with a friend. And thank you so much for being with us today. We'll see you next week here on Amazon Legends.